aux États-Unis. Yanis Amilakis est un des noms les plus, les mieux connus en matière d'archéologie et d'histoire de l'archéologie, parce qu'il a énormément produit et dans des domaines et avec des perspectives extrêmement intéressantes. Je citerai The Nations and Its Ruins, La Nation et ses ruines, Archaeology, Antiquity and National Imagination in Modern Greece, une histoire donc de l'archéologie, l'antiquité et l'imaginaire national en Grèce contemporaine. Archaeologies and the Senses, l'archéologie et les sens, Human Experience, Memory and Affect, une prise de position extrêmement intéressante sur l'archéologie. Son approche a toujours été très interdisciplinaire, avec un accent sur la culture matérielle et la dimension sensorielle de l'archéologie. Il a énormément travaillé, et c'est quelque chose qui va dans le sens de notre intérêt ici, sur les archéologies dites indigènes ou locales ou prémodernes, l'histoire de l'archéologie et ses rapports avec la politique et avec le nationalisme. Il va donc nous parler justement de cette perspective-là, en combinant l'archéologie, la période de gestation de l'archéologie avec sa dimension sensorielle. Je l'invite donc à prendre le... Voilà, sensorial clashes, des conflits sensoriels dans les archéologies indigènes des terres ottomanes.
Thank you very much,
yes,
Adam,
thank
and thank you for the kind invitation. I'm very glad to be here amongst many friends and colleagues, and I've already learned a lot from their presentations, and I'm looking forward to our discussion today. As Adam explained, my perspective is somehow different in the sense that I'm interested on what we call indigenous archaeology of the Ottoman lands, in the sense that the local actors we've been talking about, for me, take a slightly different meaning. They're not so much the educated elites, they're not so much the governors, Christian or Muslim, they're mostly the people that anthropologists would call people without history, people who, for whom we have no written sources, people who are mostly illiterate, people who we find it very difficult to find any concrete evidence in the archives, and yet, people whom I think they had their own perception, logic, but also set of practices involving material things of another time. And I've been trying for some time now to understand these perceptions. This is part of a broader project in trying to write what we can call the social lives of ruins, based mostly on these local actors and their own appreciation of material things of another time. I'm also very happy that many of the things that I'll be talking about have been already touched upon by many of my colleagues here, and including many of the actors that I'm going to refer to, so I do not have to give too much background information of many of those. I will start with a vignette, an episode, a specific clash that Defri already referred to, and that's the clash between the Cambridge scholar and antiquarian Clark and the people of Ulysses or Eleusina in Attica. So when in 1801, the Cambridge scholar and antiquarian Edward Clark arrived in Ulysses, not far from Athens, the site associated with the ancient religion and with the goddess Demeter, he could not hide his excitement. The place was littered with antiquities, but it was one specific find he was keen on, having read about it in other earlier travelers' accounts. George Weller was one of them in 1676. A large marble upper torso female figure known as the Ceres or Demeter of Ulysses, but in fact a first century BC statue of a Caryatid, not a representation of a goddess as was then thought. But he was not the only one at the time interested in this statue. And I quote, "We found it," he will note, "in the midst of a heap of dung," as the priest already said, "buried as high up as the neck." And he will continue. "The inhabitants of the small village, which is now situated amongst the ruins of Ulysses, still regarded this statue with a high degree of superstitious veneration. They attributed its presence the fertility of their land. And it was to this reason that they heaped around it manure intended for their fields. They believed that the loss of it would be followed, but no less than the failure of their annual harvest. And they pointed to the ears, of the bearded wheat amongst the sculptured ornaments upon the head of the figure as a never-failing indication of the produce of the soil." So you see here an interesting kind of depiction of a set of beliefs and set of kind of ideas based on detailed kind of details, ornamental details of the actual sculpture itself. So Clark managed to secure a permit from the local Ottoman voivode in exchange of a telescope belonging to Elgin's employee Luzieri. And this is also interesting, you know, a telescope being exchanged for the firman, for the permit to actually take it away. The main obstacle for them, however, for Clark and his associates, was not the lack of a permit, he already had that, but the resistance of local people, the people of Ulysses. In Clark's words, they were respecting an idol which they all regarded as the protectors of their fields, and in front of which they used to place a burning lamb during festival days, as they would did with Christian icons. So the same kind of practice of veneration as you would do with an icon. Local people refused to collaborate in its removal, and they believed that the arm of any person who dared to touch the marble or disturb its position would fall off. Interestingly, it was the local priest who intervened and secured the removal. He, the priest, would put on his canonical vestments, as for a ceremony of high mass, and descending into the hollow where the statue remained upright, after the rubbish around it had been cleared and taken away, gave the first blow with a pickaxe for the removal of the soil, that the people might be convinced no calamity would befall the laborers. Interestingly, the ship that was carrying this statue to England sank. Eleusinians, Clark notes, and I quote, predicted the wreck of the ship which should convey it. And it's a curious circumstance that their augury was completely fulfilled. The local people of Ulysses, as later travelers such as Dodwell would record, lamented the loss of the statue for many years to come. And sure enough, several poor harvests also followed, according again to travelers. The statue was retrieved, of course, after the wreckage, and ended up at Cambridge at the Fitzwilliam Museum, where it can actually be seen today, and we've seen already this photo, exhibited high up compared to the height of a human being and against the wall and in a niche, as you see here. So in a very different setting, but also in a very different kind of logic in terms of exhibition. You could not really appreciate the whole statue, only its frontal side. And the aftermath of this story, however, is perhaps best evoked in the relevant text from the website of this museum today, from the Fitzwilliam Museum, which writes, "Recognizing the quality and importance of the statue, Clark decided to remove it. He winched the statue out of its dungy bed and shipped it to England, but it did not travel willingly. The ship carrying the Caryatid and other findings, and other items collected by Clark, sank off Beachy Head on the south coast of England. Sorry, as we see, and as Emily already mentioned, I think these contemporary evocations of these stories are important for us today, because we do need to understand how these earlier perceptions actually continue all the way to the present day, even in contemporary museum context. So the story of the series of Ulysses, which only a few years later, in 1813, would become, at least for another traveler, Hobhouse, known that as the series of Cambridge, is an apt opening to the theme of my talk today. I'm starting with this story because, as I've discussed elsewhere, especially in the chapter published in the book edited by LDM called Scramble for the Past, a book that I think is crucial for our discussion today, I think this story helps us to understand a number of important processes involving antiquities, which only recently we came to appreciate and until now eluded us. I've made the claim that stories such as these vividly illustrate a fundamental clash, a clash between two different archaeological traditions. In this case, it is a clash between the various pre-modern indigenous archaeologies in plural, of the local people, in this case, the local people of Ulysses, and on the other hand, the modern or the modernist Western antiquarianism and proto-archaeology represented by Clark. I've also claimed that these different pre-modern archaeologies embody and materialize distinctive perceptions on materiality and temporality, which speak to our contemporary concerns, contemporary philosophical reflections on matter, on time, and on the entanglement of things with humans. In doing so, I have defined archaeology not simply as a scholarly and professional field, but in the broader sense, as the discourses and practices involving material things of another time. And in that respect, in that broad definition of archaeology, the people of Ulysses here were practicing their own archaeology. They had noticed the statue. They had exhibited it in a very specific way, in its close to its original context, and they had created a discourse about it, a story about it, based on the observations they made of its specific sculptural details. Remember the urns of corn and how they can be linked to fertility and to the land. But also they venerated. Remember that they were burning a candle, they were burning a lamp in front of it, as they would do with icons. And last but not least, and relevant to my discussion today, they would heap dung around it as the most appropriate substance offering to a goddess that is linked, or to a spirit or a being that is linked to the fertility of the land. Clark, on the other hand, belonged, of course, to a wave of antiquarians and travelers of the late 18th and early 19th century who developed a proto-scientific, proto-archaeological attitude and gaze. In contrast to earlier travelers who would be guided primarily by a literary gaze and were interested mostly in architecture and the landscape in general, this latter group started paying specific attention to objects and artifacts, not simply the landscape or the literal evocations of landscape. This development, of course, was taking place, as we've already seen, in a wider international climate marked by intensification of the appropriation and plundering of antiquities. An intensification which was characterized by nationalist competition, especially between the British and the French, at a time when Greece and Southeastern Europe in general had become more accessible and more desirable for Western Europeans. At the same time, however, national imaginings and desires amongst educated Greeks, Greek-speaking intellectuals, and the emerging middle classes in the area that we now call Greece were becoming more widespread. largely due to the adoption of the idea of Western Hellenism by those groups and those people, and of course the glorification of classical antiquity. Within this social and intellectual climate, and Miller, guided not only by the colonial desire for the objects and artifacts of antiquity, but also by the scientific belief in accuracy and detail, this group of travelers, this latter group of travelers, came into contact, into a dialogue, but also into conflict with local people. While in the previous occasions in some of the publications, I attempted to outline the contours of some of these archaeologists active in the Ottoman Empire, and I've started charting what I consider to be the clashes between these different archaeologies. Today I want to emphasize another clash, a specific clash, a clash between different sensorial regimes, different regimes about the senses, between different modes of relating to the sensorial properties of matter, especially matter of another time, matter as seen of another time. In doing so, I bring together the two different kind of main research interests of mine, the sociopolitics of antiquities and the work on the senses and the archaeology of the body and sensoriality in general. Very briefly, one word on my terminology, because I know, and has already been expressed, it does cause lots of reactions. So, especially the use of term archaeologists to describe these practices. I'm aware that many people find it problematic. For example, I know that Alain Schnapf would prefer the term antiquarianism, perhaps vernacular antiquarianism, or other colleagues, including Ben Anderson, would rather use the term local interpreters to describe the social actors who are engaging these practices. And my good friend and Brown colleague, Felipe Rojas, would use the term archaeophilia and archaeophiles. I would insist, however, in the use of the term archaeologist for several reasons, some epistemic and some ethical and political. First, because I want to valorize them, valorize these practices against the colonial accusation of ignorance, superstition, or irrationality. But I also want to remove them from the domain of folklore studies, which is often being kind of delegated to. Second, because I want to use the term archaeologist, because I think they constitute a rich body of ideas, discourses, often tacit discourses, and practices that can fertilize our own understanding today and our understanding and perception of antiquities. And they are not simply a set of exotic, peculiar customs. To deny such a right to an alternative archaeology would be to reproduce the colonial distinction between the West, in its various, of course, forms and guises, which possesses science and scholarship, and the rest, which possess custom, ethnological interest, and folklore. It's a well-known distinction from anthropology and from other fields. Third, because I want to insist in using archaeology, because such valorization would benefit us all who work within the domain of archaeology, of modern archaeology today. In using that term, these archaeologists would actually hold a mirror in front of us and ask us to question our own assumptions on materiality, time, and history. We will consider why we're doing things today in the way we do compared to other frames and other ways of doing things with antiquity. Finally, I want to continue using archaeologists because none of the other suggestions seem appropriate to me. Antiquarianism is heavily loaded, and it also prioritizes knowledge and understanding, at least in the definition given by Ben Anderson, who claims that antiquarianism is the attempt to understand the past through interaction with objects that exist in the present, the attempt to understand the past. So that prioritization, which is not always the case in other archaeologies. The term local interpreters equally emphasizes interpretation, whereas many local alternative or indigenous archaeologies are much more complex and go beyond the attempt to interpret and to understand, especially when they involve active engagement and reworking of the material past, not just simply understanding. And archaeophilia, my friend Felipe's is there, sounds too pathological to me. As for the term indigenous, I'm aware of its difficulties and problematic connotations, given that it's normally used in colonial contexts such as the US, Canada, or Australia. But my use here is deliberate. I wanted to connect our discussion with global debates on indigeneity, but also colonization and decolonization. And while the geographical focus of my presentation cannot be easily compared to a settler colonial context such as the US, for example, I wanted to allude to the process of colonization I see happening also in this area, the Ottoman Empire. Colonization of ideas, first of all, colonization of the ideas of Western Hellenism and nationalism, but also sociopolitical kind of colonization of the region of the Ottoman Empire by Western capitalist modernity and its main agents. At another occasion, perhaps, we can talk about this process of colonization, but also perhaps discuss the crypto-colonization or the concept of crypto-colony as debated and proposed by the anthropologist Michael Hertzfeld. But that's another story. I would like to return now to our kind of discussion about these antiquities. So the incident I actually described a few minutes ago, in this case, the modernist archaeology of Clark, did not simply orientalize these people and their discourses and practices confident of its superiority, which was ironically based on false knowledge about a specific statue. More importantly, this archaeological gaze was grounded on the assumption that such a work of art could not possibly be left lying amongst the dung. And dung, manure, as a substance, but also as a metaphor, becomes crucial here. Consider animality versus humanity. Consider barns and stables versus museums and salons. Consider the olfactory process and the olfactory presence and evocation of dung versus the olfactory neutrality of the museum. So the sense of smell is key here in this specific understanding of these practices. In evoking antiquities buried in dung, in alluding to this substance, but also to animality, is in speaking about works of art surrounded by dirt, Clark is repeating a common trope amongst antiquarians since at least the 18th century, whereby the Western European lover of art would heroically rescue antiquities found amongst rubbish. And you read this kind of trope in many different travelers' accounts that these are amongst rubbish and they had to be removed from that context. This modernist archaeology also advocated the removal of the statue to the more appropriate surroundings of Cambridge University, where it could be appreciated visually, primarily through the sense of autonomous vision, by English connoisseurs, and to be used for artistic, of course, and archaeological instruction. Now, the indigenous archaeologists of Eleusinians, however, ironically placed more attention to context than the archaeology of Clark had done. But also, they through their own exhibition practice, they allowed for a fully embodied, multisensorial experience and appreciation of that object, which also included the olfactory contact with a dump of heat, which offended not only the nose of Clark, but also, it seems, the noses of present-day curators of the Fitzwilliam Museum. So this has been not only a clash of two distinctive archaeological traditions, but also a sensorial clash, or rather a clash of two distinctive sensorial regimes. Clark's aesthetics, in the sense of aesthesis, sense, which was akin to an abstract, objectifying gaze, whereas the aesthetics or sensoriality of Eleusinians were mostly truly multisensorial. Or take another example discussed by Ben Anderson in a recent article Based on the traveler of one of the actors we have seen today several times, the French antiquarian, diplomat, and academician, Jean Gouffier, who traveled in Greece and write in 1782 about a Roman sarcophagus which he encountered on the island of Sifnos. He writes in the translation provided by Ben, "The tomb is finally executed. Made perhaps to commemorate a hero, the barbarity of the inhabitants has consigned it to the vilest of uses. All the monuments of Greece experience the same fate." Barbarity and vilest of uses is important here to note. "Even stables," again, the notion of a stable and animality, "even stables are constructed with these finest remains. One cannot step in this country without coming across masterpieces, remains of what she once possessed, and testaments to what she has lost." Now, if you take a look at the images that actually accompany this specific passage and this specific account, you will see that while iconographically it partakes of the idea of the picturesque, and cites the standard conventions of a romantic depiction of ruins, especially in relation to vegetation and plants. At the same time, the portrayal of the use of the sarcophagus as a cistern, the interference of peasant figures with it, but also the presence of the dog, alludes to that the same trope, the trope of barbarity, dirt, animality. So these elements are present. Other iconographic depictions of antiquities at the same time point to the same direction. And we've seen this image before again. This is, of course, from the Antiquities of Athens, the well-known work as part of the Society of the Dilettanti. And James Stewart here portrays a messy landscape, the messy landscape of the Acropolis of Athens. But that specific image also has strong olfactory connotations. By the way, Stewart seemed to have been very fond of depicting animal presences next to antiquities. And here is another, this is the detail with animals from the same image, and this is another image again from the Society of Athens. So this is a multi-species that perhaps needs further and more exploration. How do animals fit into this whole story about depicting antiquities? And what does it say about the distinction between humanity and animality in the discourse of these travelers, proto-archaeologists, and antiquarians? Ironically, it seems that this rich local olfactory appreciation reception of antiquities in the 18th century Ottoman lands has more affinities with the multisensorial world of classical antiquity. And if we think about classical antiquity, we think of, you know, very often animal sacrifices, we think of blood, we think of feces, we think of feasting, we think of music, we think of dance. So all this kind of world that is very rich and multisensorial is a contradiction to the austere olfactory neutral world and the aesthetic appreciation that many of these proto-archaeologists and antiquarians are actually constructing. And talking of sound, voice, and the auditory, it is well known that in the ontology of matter that these alternative archaeologists had constructed, ancient sculptures were not objects, they were subjects. They had human qualities, they were anthropomorphized, they were kind of speaking statues in many ways. They spoke, they cried, and they sang. Take, for example, the well-known stories from many travelers' accounts about the caryatids from the Erechtheion, especially following the removal of one of them by Elgin. So if we were to read Hobhouse, he would note that a curious notion prevailing amongst the common Athenians with respect to the ancient statues, namely that they are real bodies, mutilated and enchanted into their present state of petrification by magicians who'd have power over them as long as the Turks are masters of Greece, or they will be transformed into their former bodies. The spirit within them is called an Arabim, and it is not infrequently heard to mourn and bewail its condition. Some Greeks in our time, conveying a chest from Athens to Piraeus containing parts of the Algier marbles, threw it down and could not for some time be prevailed upon it to touch it, again affirming that they heard the Arabim crying out, and go among its fellow spirits detained in bondage in the Acropolis. Douglas would also note the same phenomenon and mention that he was told by an illiterate servant of the Disdard of Athens that, and I quote, when the other girls had lost their sister, they manifested their affliction by filling the air at the close of the evening with the most mournful sighs and lamentations. The ravished sister was not deaf to their voice, but astonished the lower town where she was placed by answering in the same lamentable tones. So these indigenous archaeologists were not simply projecting alternative interpretations of the same phenomena. They weren't just describing a different explanation of the same thing compared to the antiquarians. They were not simply structured by different epistemologies. They were looking at rather sensorially experiencing things of another time, and they were seeing, sensing, and experiencing different things. They were not hearing voices of the same phenomenon. They were hearing voices and they were affected by the sound and the auditory impact of the lament. So my point here is that what the antiquarians were seeing and what local people were seeing were not the same thing. They were seeing different things and they were understanding this statue as very, very different, as living, as people that had affective, emotional impact that would touch also local people and others. So beyond olfactory and auditory experiences, the tactile and the kinesthetic reception of these ancient things were also very different. The interaction of the various local communities with them was intensely tactile and thoroughly corporeal. This interaction went hand in hand with the ideas about the agency of these ancient things, as we saw in some of the examples earlier, their ability to shape people's lives, guarantee their fertility, the fertility of their fields, but also the fertility of their own, the fertility of women, or even cure bodily disease. It is well known that the people of Athens attributed such agentic qualities to ancient stones around the Pnyx on the hill opposite to the Athenian Acropolis. So Hobhouse will tell us that he heard the women often used to slide down the polished surfaces in one of the crags of the Pnyx, in the belief that in doing so they would increase their chances of conceiving and bearing male offspring. And he notes and continues, towards the Areopagus is a small, smooth descent which has been worn even and slippery by the effects of a singular persuasion prevalent amongst the females of Athens of both religions, that married women conceive, that by sliding uncovered down the stone, they increase their chance of bringing forth male children. And I saw one of them myself in this exercise, which appeared to me not only disagreeable, but indeed rather perilous. Then, of course, this was not a unique case. This belief in the agentic qualities of these stones was not a unique case. Hunt, for example, the chaplain of Elgin, would refer to similar stories involving the well-known inscription of Sigion, the pillaging of which was also highly contested by local people, as we know, and which is now stored in the British Museum. And Hand would note that at the Ennisher, the custom was to roll the patient to the marble stone, which contained the Sigion inscription. the characters of which have never been deciphered by any of their didascaly teachers, and they were supposed to contain a powerful charm. This practice, however, had nearly obliterated this inscription. Above everything else, however, beyond these specific cases, as other colleagues have already noted, and I agree with them, we seem to have an empire-wide alternative understanding and perception of antiquities, which included, as I try to explain here, sensorial clashes amongst antiquarians and others. But there are also these specific kind of regimes of understanding and thinking and sensorial appreciation are also structured by two other specific practices that I can only refer to briefly. The first is the embedding of these things of another time into the fabric of daily life, into houses, into mosques, into churches, into places of worship. They were intermingled with diverse sounds, smells, sights, and other truly multisensorial experiences. And the second practice is the intense interference with them, the reworking, the reshaping, the resculpturing into something else. And of course, the recontextualization, the placing into a different context. Of course, this reworking is described by scholars within the context of spolia, or use, or intentional destruction, supposedly the result of ignorance, superstition, or utilitarian gain. Such interpretations and framings, however, are not only theoretically reductionist, to call them just destruction, or superstition, or ignorance, but also self-serving. The aim, as far as the Western antiquarians and protoarchaeologists are concerned, was to justify the pillage. They are destroyed, they are put into very inappropriate uses, and therefore we need to rescue them. We need to take them into a different context, to an austere environment of the museum, or the lavish interior of an aristocratic salon, where they could be admired primarily through the autonomous sense of disembodied vision. Now, these indigenous practices of intermingling and reworking are present, as we know, in folk tales, in the material archaeological record, and also recorded in text and illustration by many travelers and illustrators at this time. They also be recorded from, by the way, this is the Sigeon inscription I referred to, and some of these kind of pictorial representations of this reworking of the material trace of ancient past into something else. And you can see the figure to the right from William Parse in this case, of somebody turning these things, these columns into Muslim tombstones. And we've seen the same practice here in the earlier image. And in fact, even in the Acropolis of Athens today, you can see some of these traces, such as the top of tombstones here, as part of the rubble, of course, not collected, unfortunately, but as part of the rubble you can now find on the Acropolis, pointing to the same practice and coming from the Muslim cemetery, which was at the Propylaea of the Athenian Acropolis. And this is the inscription, of course, from the Erechtheum, but with inscription inscribed, Ottoman inscription inscribed in 1805, praising the leader of the Acropolis and placing this on the entrance of the Propylaea. But these, by the way, this is another spolio of 19th century showing a Roman relief into a contemporary house. But many of these practices of intermingling and reworking will be also recorded in later years, since 1839, by photography. And you can see one of the earliest photographs, this one, a daguerreotype by Giraud de Brangy, showing in the Roman Agora of Athens the proximity of these kind of architectural and other material traces with the spaces and architectural and buildings of contemporary life. And in later years, and this is from photographer Felix Monfils, who traveled to Athens in the 1860s and 70s and recalled the transformation, the isolation of the classical, the architectural kind of separation of the classical from the domain of life and domain of all other kind of buildings around it. But you also record hybrid practices, and this is very interesting and also a matter of another discussion. Now, this enigmatic photo, again by Bonfils, is something that people attribute to a practice carried out by the first Greek archaeologist in Greece, Pitakis, Kyriakos Pitakis, and it is more likely to be a practice that he called pinakes, which is the assembling of things from many different periods, they have many different contexts, and building them into a wall in order to protect them. But this kind of image that photographers then photographed as something appealing points to that kind of hybrided practices of spolia in the pre-modern time and archaeology, modernist archaeology, the attempt to rescue them by creating some sort of a modern sculpture based on these many different things of another time. So we can see now through photography how some of these ideas, some of these indigenous archaeologies are being transformed by modernist archaeology, which since the foundation of the nation state of Greece in the 1830s became established first by barbarians and then increasingly by other local Greek archaeologists. So to conclude very briefly with two sentences. Now in anthropology and in archaeology right now, there is an intense ongoing discussion on different ontologies. Not only different worldviews, but different worlds, and how different worlds can be reconciled. Very often, ethnographic examples include Amerindian societies in South America, or circumpolar societies, but also indigenous cultures around the world. I have claimed today that many inhabitants of the Ottoman Empire may have partaken of such different worlds in which a distinctive sensorial experience and understanding was fundamental, an experience which often brought them into clash with the Western ontologies and sensorial and experiential frameworks. I'm not claiming that there was complete separation or incommensurability, complete separation with the lack of any shared space of understanding. There was, of course, and there was kind of mutual kind of exchange of thoughts and ideas. Increasingly, towards the end of the 18th and 19th century, we see, as I just mentioned, hybrid frameworks, things that come into kind of contact and copy each other, cross-fertilization. But I'm claiming, however, that the study of such sensorial clashes and of these different worlds, different ontologies, but also epistemologies, will add a completely unknown chapter in the history of antiquities in the Ottoman lands, and would also enrich our own contemporary thinking about materiality, about time, and also about human experience. Thank you very much for listening.